to this gentleman we first met Friday night out at Akron Canton Airport. And we've spent most of the time since with him. And I can sincerely say that this is a very fine human being. He's warm and he's sincere and every bit a gentleman, even when Father Charles steals his salad. So it's with a deep sense of gratitude and a great deal of pleasure. I give you the speaker for this morning, Tom Beebe of Charlotte, North Carolina.
My name is Tom Brady, Jr., and I'm an alcoholic. I couldn't help but think, as Ed was up here this morning talking about weakness, that by the grace of God, my greatest weakness has become my greatest strength. Have you thought about that lately? And only by the grace of God. We're carriers of a great power, and the power doesn't belong to me. It belongs to God. But it's mine anytime. All I got to do is ask. This has been a tremendously emotional experience for me, especially this morning at the graveside and listening to Tom. To me, coming to Akron is like coming to a holy place because the seeds of my new life were sown right here 40 years ago. I'm a miracle, folks. And so are you. I don't know how much of a miracle I am. You know, I came to AA. By the grace of God, it hasn't been necessary for me to take a drink since July 20th, 1965. But I came here with sweaty palms, my hands shaking, and having to go to the bathroom. This morning, I got sweaty palms, my hands are shaking, and I'm about to wet my pants. I gotta go to the bathroom. Go ahead. I wish I could go with you. John's not so special with his dual problem. I've got a dual problem too. In addition to being an alcoholic, I'm a Baptist. And being a Baptist is a lot like being an alcoholic. You know, once an alcoholic, always an alcoholic. Once a Baptist, always a Baptist. I used to, with tongue in cheek, tell my wife, who's a staunch Baptist, that I suffered from two diseases, but by the grace of God, I was recovering from both. Our book says that our description of the alcoholic, the chapter to the agnostic, and our personal adventures before and after make clear three pertinent ideas. A, that we were alcoholic and could not manage our own lives. B, that probably no human power could have relieved our alcoholism. And C, that God could and would if he were sought. Every time I talk basically about two things. I talk about powerlessness and I talk about power. In other words, I talk about me and I talk about God. Because my very life depends on the recognition of who is who. I kept me mixed up with God for a long time. I had to control. And now I try my best on a daily basis to let him control. And for a person with the ego the size of mine, this is not an easy thing to do. Alcoholism is a fatal and an incurable disease. And I just got to say, you're one of the finest looking groups of diseased people I ever saw in my life. And every time I get up and talk, I tell a story that makes me feel comfortable. Let me tell you one other. It doesn't have anything to do with AA or anything else. This guy came home and told his wife he had bought a new condominium. She said, "That's wonderful. Now I can throw away my diagram." North Carolina, where I'm from, we have a region called the Sand Hills that is a very sandy region and is covered with longleaf pines, very tall pine trees. And there's a story told about a little boy. His name was Lou. Every day he'd go out in the pine forest, and along about sundown he'd be lost, and you can't shimmy up a tall pine tree, and they'd have to send out a search party to look for Lou every day, bring him home. His mother told him one night, "Lou, next time you're out there and you're lost, and get out on your knees and ask God to show you a way out. He'll do it." Lou listened. The next day he's out and he's playing. Sun's going down. He's lost in the woods again. He remembers what his mother said. Very reverently, he got down on his knees and he says, "Lord, I'm lost. And I want you to show me by some sign how to get out of here. Amen." And he got up and he held his hand out here and nothing happened. And he held it out here and nothing happened. And he held it out here and nothing happened. And he held it out front. A little bird flew over and dropped one right in his hand. He looks at it, shakes it off, gets back down on his knees and again very reverently says, "Lord, don't hand me no crap. I'm really lost." I really don't know what direction I'm going to take, so if God doesn't give us a sign, we're in bad trouble. And you know, I was thinking, we're up here where all the big rubber companies are, and I sponsored a guy from Goodyear one time. Beautiful man. Been sober 4 years now. His name is Doug. Some of the greatest examples of humor are not the made-up stories, they're the real thing. After Doug was sober about 3 months, he got called down to Atlanta, Georgia, and he was afraid he was going to be fired from his job, so he asked me, his sponsor, to go with him, and we got on an airplane and we went down. And Doug didn't get fired. Matter of fact, he got a few pats on the back. Felt very good about it. We were out of the airport in Atlanta afterwards, and we're standing up at one of those stand-up hot dog tables having a hot dog. And I'm from a different generation, folks. I haven't gotten used to the braless look yet. I don't think I ever will. Not that I don't like it, I just ain't used to it. And this gal comes walking along in the airport, and she's about the most braless thing I'd ever seen in my life. And Doug and I transfixed our eyes on her, you know, and I'm not going to lie to you, we watched her all the way by, you know. She passed by, and she had some nice attributes on the other side, so we kept watching. That's my third problem. Doug turns around to me and he says, "Tom, that gal sure does remind me of Alcoholics Anonymous." I said, "How?" He said, "Man, she's self-supporting through her own contributions." I guess we better get down to the nitty-gritty. I'm not going to talk to you much about drinking this morning. It's hard for me to identify with a lot of other alcoholics' drinking patterns, and it would be hard for you to identify with mine. Our book says that drinking is just a symptom. I believe that. And our drinking patterns are different. It's obvious. Talk to the person beside you. We differed. We had guys who drank every day, a fifth a day. We had guys like me who were periodics you could measure by the calendar. All kinds of people. Where my identification has come in Alcoholics Anonymous is the way I felt inside. The thoughts that I thought, the things that I did, the feelings that ran around inside of me all the time. I really believe that in this program, when we forget about drinking patterns, we're just about 95% alike. I heard a lady say one time that if you'll tell me your name and that you're an alcoholic, I can give you the other 90%. And I believe this. So I'm not going to talk much about that. I'm going to talk about what went on inside of me. It's the problems inside of me that it was necessary for me to do something about. And if I did not, it would be necessary for me to have another medicine. Be it alcohol, drugs, or something else. So I'm going to talk about my insides, and I kind of hope it clicks with you. As far back as I can remember, I was afraid. I read a book once by a psychologist, and he listed 206 different phobias. And I read through, and I got to the end of the list, read, and I'd had them all. And I got to the end of the list, and I said, no, that's not all. There's one more. Fear number 207. This fear that every alcoholic on the face of God's earth has known. The fear of impending calamity. And it goes like this, oh my God. I don't know what's going to happen to me, and I don't know who's going to do it, and I don't know when or where it's going to happen. But something's going to happen to me, and it's going to be bad. Fear number 207. And I had a lot to be afraid about. I want you to know that. I was the ugliest kid you ever saw. My mom said, and this is true, she had never seen an ugly baby until I was born. She didn't take me out of the house for 6 weeks. I was redder than you're supposed to be in the wrong places. I was ugly. I've seen pictures. Psychiatrist told me one time, boy, that must have really hurt you when she told you that. I said, why? It was true. And as I grew up, people called me Puddinhead and Cotton Top because guess what? I had snow white hair on top of my head and wall-to-wall freckles. I had freckles all over me, bottom of my feet to the top of my head. And every picture I ever had taken, I was hanging onto my mama's apron string, squinching one eye with my knees knocked together. I got rid of the freckles before I did the apron string. I want you to know that. I hung on to that for a long time. Times now I want to hang on to it. Mamas and their apron strings we get attached to. I was ugly. I really was. No doubt about it. I used to figure myself, hey, if I get rid of these freckles, I'll have it made. And you know about the age of 13 I got rid of those freckles? They were replaced by the most beautiful set of pimples you ever saw in your life. My mom and daddy always told me if you did certain things, you'd get pimples on your face, you know? I want you to know I really didn't do any of those things. But when I walked down the street, all they had to do was look at my face and they knew what I was doing. And I was good at it. I'm not going to lie. Had a natural talent for it. Psychiatrist told me one time that it was one of the best relievers of tension in the world, and boy, was I tense. I couldn't get free, folks. So I became what is known in the trade as a perfectionist. I set out on a path to do every job I ever did better and quicker than anybody else had ever done it. I always had to be on top, never second place, always in the spotlight, always number one. And if I found out I couldn't do a job better than somebody else, I'd sneak away so nobody would know it. And I talk about perfectionism at some AA meetings, and I see people shaking their heads. Perfectionism has levels, you know. Can you walk into your home, sit down, and look at a crooked picture for over 15 seconds without straightening it? When your kids go out of the house with you, do they have to be just perfect, every hair in place because of the reflection it might make on you? Do you check the silverware in the restaurants for spots? Do you hold the glasses up and look at them? Then you're a perfectionist. And I think all alcoholics are perfectionistic to some degree. And I was a good perfectionist. In the Baptist church, there was a group for boys called the Royal Ambassadors for Christ. Now, the highest rank in that outfit was Ambassador Plenipotentiary. Ain't that a mouthful? I couldn't pronounce the word, but I was one quicker than anybody else had ever been one. And they put the spotlight on me, and they patted me on the back, and they had me recite memory verses. My God, could I recite memory verses? You just mash my button. You know, I figured when you had the spotlight on me, you were patting me on the back, you were liking me, that you couldn't hurt me. Real good thinking. When I was 17 years old, I borrowed a bass fiddle from the band director at the high school, Jim. I took it home, put a new G-string on it, practiced solid. For 2 weeks, almost drove my mom and dad crazy, plunking on that bull fiddle. But at the end of 2 weeks, at 17 years of age, I was playing with a college dance band. That's what a perfectionist will do. The one person who was never pleased by my perfection was, guess who? Me. I never could do anything good enough to suit me. Now, perfectionism has two extremes. If I wasn't the best, I was automatically the worst. Do you hear me? Alcoholics are either or people. Either we're on top or we just gotta be on the bottom. And what Alcoholics Anonymous has taught me is there's a continuum here. There's a thing called life and living and doing and loving and feeling in between these extremes. And that's where I'm supposed to live. That's where God wants me to be. But I didn't know that. And I had to excel so you wouldn't hurt me. And I built a wall around me, a big high wall. And it was built out of the stones of resentment and this fear. Guilt. You know the list if you've taken your inventory. And when I needed you, I'd run out from behind my wall and I'd use you. And then I'd run back real quick before you could hurt me. And I was gifted with a good mind. So I was an intellectual also. I know now I was a pseudo-intellectual. I ain't that smart. I had to get real dumb before I could get sober. We got a PhD at home. That boy couldn't stay sober, save his life. PhD in anatomy and physiology. Taught classes on alcoholism and couldn't stay sober. I stopped him out in the hall outside the meeting place. Arrogant? You know? And use these $10 words? Stopped him outside in the hall one night. I said, hey, let me tell you something. I said, out here in the world, you're a PhD in anatomy and physiology. When you pass through that door, you're just a drunk like the rest of us. And what's more, you're a new drunk and you don't know a damn thing. So shut up your mouth and take $9.98 off those words. You've been sober 7 years. He's back up to 50 cents words. I got to have a talk to him. But I was an intellectual. I had a good mind. I have a photographic memory. I didn't learn anything in college, by the way. I graduated with a 3.94 average out of a possible 4. But I was the best test taker you ever saw. I could take a set of notes, and when you asked me the questions, I could picture the notes by the numbers in my mind and take that test. And people would applaud, you know, and pat me on the back. Hey, Tom, you made 100 on that test. I'd apologize for making 100. When I went through college up in North Carolina, I graduated with that big average. I was elected to who's who among students in American universities and colleges my junior and senior year. I was in every honor society they had. I was president of my class several times, chaplain of the Senate. How about that one? Everything was great. Our book talks about the actor. The part of us that we want the world to see. And it talks about the other part. The feelings inside. The liar. And the knower. And the liar's on the outside and the knower's on the inside. And the only trouble about lying is the knower knows you're lying. And you can't live comfortably when the knower knows. I had so many scholarships, when I graduated from that college, they owed me $16. And I can take you to my home and show you my college annuals, and there's a beautiful half-page picture of me sitting up there all arrogant on that chair. And underneath my pedigree, and boy, it's something else. I read that sometimes and say, boy, you smart. You know, when they took the first picture, I was so hungover, I was about to shake out of the chair. When they took the second one, I was so drunk, I was about to fall out of the chair. That's the actor for you. And I was very much an actor. And I'm very much like Chuck C. from California talks about. He says, some of us are so smart, we damn near die. And I almost did. My God. And I'm a romantic. Idealist, whatever you want to call it. I came into this world thinking everything ought to be beautiful. You ever felt that way? And I looked around me, man, it was ugly. Even I was ugly. Everything was ugly. Nothing was right. And I love candles, and I love music. And man, I love to breathe today and look and be able to smell even the bad smells. It's been given back to me. I used to sit around and daydream about what I wanted to be. That's what romantics do. Whatever I was, I didn't want to be that. Everything I ever mastered, once I mastered it, didn't make any difference. I was through with it. Send me on to something else. I used to say to my wife when I was drinking, how would you like to be married to a Baptist minister who practices law and medicine on the side? Now, I'm not fully recovered. I still do that. I sit around and dream about, you know, I get the poor little old me sometimes and say, Tom, if you hadn't wasted so much time, you could have been anything you wanted to be. And what I overlooked there is that I'm a new person now. I can still be anything I want to be. By the grace of God. When we talk about insanity in this program, that's insane. Insane people all have one thing in common. You go in the back ward of any mental hospital, and there'll be at least one patient that they've given up on, and he's balled up in the fetal position, and he's giggling, humming, singing, and talking to himself. Because he thinks there's no one else to talk to. Okay? And we look at this guy and we say, boy, there's somebody else to talk to. That's a lie. He's sick. Tut, tut. And we run into the paranoid who's developed a system to break the bank out in Las Vegas. And he thinks somebody's chasing him trying to get it. Some of them are here today, by the way. He doesn't have a system and nobody's trying to get it. It's a lie. And we look at him and we say, boy, he believes in a lie, Casey. He's sick. He's crazy. In our arrogance. Let me tell you about Tom. No matter how many jails or hospitals or automobile wrecks and all various kinds of trouble that I got into, could tell myself the alcoholic's lie. This time, Tom, it's going to be different. This time, if you just handle it right, you'll be able to drink like everybody else. That's what our book says is the obsession of every problem drinker. And it says this obsession, this illusion has to be smashed. And if you're sober, you've been smashing at it. I got a friend up in Raleigh that tells a story. I'll steal it from him because he ain't here. He says you can take an alcoholic, a schizophrenic, and a normal person and put them in this room. And tonight, when they walk, it's that morning when they walk out the door over there, there's a man standing outside with a baseball bat, and he clobbers them when they walk out the door. Said the normal man will never go out that door again. He'll pick another door. Or he'll go out the window or something, you know. Only takes once. Said the old schizo walked through that door one more time just to see if it was real, you know. And he comes in touch with reality again, you know, and he ain't going through that door anymore. Said, but what about the alcoholic? Said he'll walk through that door time after time after time after time after time. And said one day he'll get there, the man with the bat ain't there. He'll sit down and wait for it. That's the way I was. It's exactly the way I was. My wife's got a cousin. How he ever lived, I don't know. He's a real kook. He's not an alcoholic. he's too kooky to be an alcoholic. When he was a kid, he'd stand out in the backyard one day arguing with a little boy across the fence. And they were really yelling and screaming. He got mad. He went in the back porch and picked up a ball peen hammer. And he came back out in the backyard and he said to the little boy, if you don't shut up and say what I want you to say, I'm going to hit you in the head with this hammer just like this. About it. Isn't it really like Chuck C. says with the alcoholic? Don't we live by the philosophy which says, I'll show you, I'll kill me. Just like this. Now, there's a very astute man up in New York called Tom Peace. And Tom Peace says, alcoholics are not sick, they're stupid. He says, you know, any dog or any cat, if you give them something to eat or drink, it makes them sick. Has the intelligence to recognize what's good for them and say yes to it, and recognize what's bad for them and say no to it. Right? Any dog and any cat. And he said, you know, alcoholics don't have that. Look at me. I kept on drinking the thing that was killing me. I had no ability to learn from my own past experience. None whatsoever. I always could tell myself the lie. This time, Tom, it's going to be different. And it was, boy, it was worse. They talk about in our book the manic depressive type of alcoholic. Folks, you are looking at a yo-yo. I was always either too happy or too sad. I was always up or I was down. Always live my life on the either-or principle. Best, worst, good, evil, up, down. It's all very logical. But you die that way. Now, I drink. Guess how? Periodically. Now, you'd say, oh, poor Tom, he drank when he was down. The hell I did. I drank when I was up. I'd go on a drunk, you know, drink everything in sight, 3 or 4 days, come off of it, apologize to everybody, join the Baptist church again. I wore a roll down the center aisle of that church. I'll tell you something, if you stand up and sing Just As I Am today, I'll join whatever you sell. I can't stand it. I'm still a Baptist. And you know, I'd get everybody off my back, get the whole world smoothed out, you know. Everything's fine. Right? Everything is beautiful. When I was sick, when I was feeling bad. And then I started eating a little bit. See? And somehow the fuel would get up to the great mind again, you see? And you know what I'd say to myself? This time it's going to be different. When things got good as a fellow at home, alcoholic, I couldn't stand it. You know why I couldn't stand it? Because I hated my guts. I had no right to succeed. I was not a good human being. I was ugly, and I was wrong, and I never did anything well. And I knew that you knew it. So that even walking down the street, I could feel you talking about me and knowing about me. Not the actor, the inside, Casey. And it really worked on the fear. And one of my worst problems, and some of you new people do not overlook in your inventory, I believe, and this is my opinion, one of the greatest character defects that an alcoholic has is that he feels he is worthless. My friend said to me after I got sober, Tom, you're a great guy. We love you. You know what I'd say? I don't see why. You ever said that? Take a look at your self-worth. Take a look at it. And take a look at what our book says about it. We got all the power in the world, baby. We ain't hurting for nothing. We can be what we want to be. We can do what we want to be. And we are beautiful, beautiful, beautiful people. Not because we're so great, as Chuck says, but because of the connection. We are God's kids. And He don't make nothing ugly. I came into Alcoholics Anonymous when I was 23 years old, first time. By the time I was 23, I'd had more than 1,000 stitches taken in my face alone. I had been in religious homes for alcoholics, psychiatric wards, jails, you name it. I had an affinity for going through windshields when I was driving drunk. I was one of the best drunk drivers you ever saw. I could drive the straightest line when I was drunk that you've ever seen. Every wreck I ever had was on a curve. There's an old-timer up in Raleigh, North Carolina, that remembers that first night that I came in AA. He said, you came in that night dragging... He's crazy as hell. It was obvious. You know what I did in AA? I sat down, and there was a man up front, and he was talking. Everybody listened to him. He had a blue book in front of him. Over on this side was 12 steps. Over on this side, 12 traditions. The great mind starts working. The old royal ambassador for Christ with his photographic memory starts thinking. And I said to me, if I memorize all that stuff, they'll make me president of this outfit in no time. And I did. I memorized it. All of it. Every jot and every tittle. When I wasn't delivering a theological or philosophical dissertation, I was drunk. You know that. For 7 years in Alcoholics Anonymous, I did my worst drinking. I didn't stay sober as much as 90 days for 7 years. And I knew everything. Bill Wilson wasn't whistling Dixie when he said this program, we speak in the language of the heart because it's a program of the heart. It is not a mind trip. I learned that the hard way. It doesn't have to do with intellect. It has to do with intelligence, and there's a whale of a difference. We have to learn how to learn from our experience to be intelligent. Seven years. I couldn't understand it. I knew it all. And I tell you, when you ask me, again, all you had to do was punch my button. Out of the sight, how it works to you. I can do that today, folks, but it ain't necessary no more. I ain't got to impress you. That's a fantastic feeling. I'd go to AA up in Burlington, North Carolina. I'd just gotten out of a religious home for alcoholics, and I decided I was going to be a Baptist minister. Ain't that something? So I was over at the college studying theology and philosophy and all that heavy stuff. I used to sit in my den, you know, in the yoga position, waiting for my spiritual awakening to happen. You know, if he can knock Paul off a jackass, he can do something special for me. It never came. The Lord got a lot of laughs out of me. I hear him up there now. There's that dum-dum again, waiting for that lightning bolt, you know. And saying to Gable, hey, he's serious too. God comes by invitation. And the invitation is a readiness and a willingness and an open heart. And I go to that AA meeting in Burlington. Bunch of common people there, you know. If you go there Tuesday night, I can tell you where everybody will be sitting in Burlington. That's true. Over on the left will be Barney. He's leaning back against the wall. Next to him is Jim S. Next to him is Martha. Two, three rows back is Freeman. Over on the right-hand side, the second row, second chair from the wall, sat the meanest man that God ever made. Named Bill C. And I called him Grumpy. And I hated Grumpy. You know why I hated Grumpy? Because he told me the truth. He never lied to me. He'd turn around to me and say, boy, how come you always run around looking for God? He ain't lost. I
You don't think your way into good living. You live your way into good thinking, I think. Cornball, shut up. They really killed me one night, you know, after I delivered a dissertation. He came up to me and very quietly said, "Boy, the good Lord gave you 2 ears and 1 mouth. Does that mean a damn thing to you?" And Grumpy was rough. And I couldn't stay sober. And I'd come in the AA meeting and I'd sit back at the back. Did you ever go to an AA meeting where you had such heavy knowledge to lay on the people that you were sitting back there waiting your turn? If you ever been to an AA discussion meeting, you've had a pretty good game of can you top this, let's be honest. We're that kind of people, you know, and that's all right. It's all right. Nothing wrong with that. But you know what? That group, they always got to me last. And I'd say, Paul Tillich said so-and-so, and Martin Buber said so-and-so, and Aristotle wrote so-and-so, and Plato in his dialogues, and old Grumpy would turn around and look at me like, "You dumb, you know." Now, in North Carolina, we give out chips, poker chips, for different lengths of sobriety. And a three-month chip is a red chip, right? And I wanted a red chip. I wanted a red chip so bad when the rest of the group go across the hall to have coffee, I've been up the chip box and stole one. I was forever missing reality. You know? The red chip is a symbol of something that's going on inside of me, and there was nothing going on, so why get a red chip? We give a white chip for a beginner. You wouldn't believe how many times I began. Made a speech every time. You know what I'd say to them? This time it's going to be different. They lost hope in me. I called Grumpy one night. I was drunk. I never called him before I took a drink. Oh, I got to tell you, I set out once to impress Grumpy. I had to get him on my side, see? He was giving me a hard time. And I went out to save a soul. Now, there's 12 steppers in AA, and they're soul savers. The 12 steppers carry the message and leave the results up to God. The soul savers will go out and get that dude sobered up, cleaned up, dressed up, put him behind the podium, and hope he'll say something about him. Charger picked up my lance and headed down to a little old town in North Carolina outside Elon College. And there's a guy laid up there drunk for 2 months in a little old white house. Didn't have indoor plumbing. You wouldn't believe that place. Maybe you would. And he was turning blue. I ran in there, you know, set my lance beside the door. Got him a doctor, went down the road and got a lady to help me, and we shoveled out that house. And then we cleaned it out and we mopped it out. He was doing all right and the house was doing all right. And I went to the telephone to call Grumpy. I wanted him to see the wonder I had wrought. And you know, in going through all that corruption in that house, I found a half a gallon of wine, and when Grumpy got there, I was drunk too. That's what a soul saver do. Go ahead and knock you off the bar stool. If you say, "Hey, I don't want to quit drinking," he'll have one with you. But I called Grumpy this night. And folks, he did the most loving thing for me that has ever been done for me in my entire life. He said, "Boy, don't you ever call me again drunk." He says, "As a matter of fact, don't you ever call me again." He said, "If you want to get sober, you know where we meet. And don't call me to come get you. As far as I'm concerned, you can walk." And he said, "Frankly, Tom, I don't give an expletive deleted whether you ever get sober or not." And that hurt my feelings. I drank some more. Had a few more wrecks. Drove under a tractor trailer one night, went straight on the curb. 3 months in traction. Introduction to morphine. Medically addicted. Went from 225 to 140 pounds and didn't care. I didn't care if I lived or died as long as you brought my morphine. If you didn't bring it, I was yelling for it. And I came out of that hospital and I couldn't walk. My leg was all busted up, and I didn't care about that either, because I went to a doctor. And, John, this was when Percodan had first came out. And Percodan was a harmless painkiller, he told me. And the first one I took, any drunk would have known it wasn't a harmless painkiller. It's like that cough syrup a doctor gave me one time. I took one tablespoonful as directed, and then I just turned up the bottle. You know? Anything that feels good, I want more. But for an alcoholic, it's not to feel good, it's to feel better. And if he feels better, it's to feel best. We're always hunting the stars. We always gotta be on top. And we never make it. Because we ain't supposed to be. We're second in command. I got myself put on 5 years probation. I was never supposed to drive in the state of North Carolina again. I showed up at Alcoholics Anonymous, and guess how I got there? I walked. Let me tell you something that's important. I did not think AA would work for me. I had tried AA. How many times have you heard that? And it hadn't worked. But there was no place else to go. And I sat on the back row, and I got there late and I left early. And then I made the finest mistake I ever made in my life. I saw this old guy, and he strutted around there, and he smoked cigars, and he seemed like he run the place. But he was a good man, and he had good eyes. And I asked him, will you sponsor me? He pointed his finger at me, and guess what he said? Boy, I've heard about you. He said, they say you're crazy. And he said, but I'll sponsor you, yes, on one condition, Tom. And I said, what's that, Harry? He said, we do it my way. And I said, what's your way, Harry? And he said, it's in that book. Get in it. Not just chapter 5. You start from the cover page. And you read it slow because you ain't smart enough to read a chapter at a time. And Harry take me on. First off, he says, you go to those meetings and you get there early. And he said, you shake everybody's hand and you ask them how they're doing. I said, I don't want to shake their hand. I don't care how they're doing. Why do I have to do that, Harry? And I was to hear this a million times. Tom, do not ask me why. Just do it. And I started shaking hands. Get that meeting early. You know what happened to me? In a few weeks, you know, I looked at shoe tops for an awful long time. And left and right and up and down, anywhere but at you. Because you knew about me. And I was scared of you. After a few weeks, I started seeing some ankles. A few shins, a few knees, up to the thigh, up to the hip, up the chest, shoulder level, and finally, thank God, I could look people straight in the eye, and I did want to shake hands, and I did care how they were doing. I believe today that the essence of the spiritual life is not some pie-in-the-sky philosophy and theology. The essence of the spiritual life is simple faith and practice, practice, practice. And that's what Harry made me do. And he'd take me on 12-step calls, and the first one I ever went on, I made my first mistake. I said, what do I say, Harry? He said, you don't know nothing. You don't say nothing. Sit down, shut up. He took me to meetings every night in the week. He said, call me 24 hours a day, and I tried him, because I didn't believe that. And he walked the floor with me in many a morning, because I was overcome with fear. That nameless one number 207. And he's loved me. And his wife loved me. And that whole group loved me. When I picked up that red chip finally, do you know the place went completely wild? In Charlotte, in my home group, they called the red chip Tom's Red Devil. But I got it. I'm sitting down at the college at work one day, you know, and I always look for things big. My spiritual experience had to be big. You know, I had to be big. Everything had to be big. Because God was big, and that's what I want to be, right? I mean, just tell it like it is. And I'm sitting there eating my bag lunch, and all of a sudden a thought comes banging into my head. I mean banging in. Hey, Tom, you haven't wanted a drink for more than 3 months. And I sat there and just cried like a baby. And I had chill bumps all over me. Three good things I've learned in AA. I can look in the eye. I can cry when I need to. And you're not a man until you can. And I can have them good old chill bumps. And chill bumps only come through grace. You know that? That good, warm, gut feeling. Hey, man, God's in his heaven. And all is right with the world. And don't forget where that heaven's at. Our book says it's deep within us. And the carpenter said, it's right in the middle of you. We got heaven in our grasp, and we never knew it. We're reaching here and yonder. We're looking everywhere. Running around looking for God, who is not lost. And we quit looking for him, and what happens? He finds us. Ain't that something? Fantastic. Bottom. I bottomed out at 30 years old, and I thank God for the bottom. Why is it that when all the stops are out, everything's out of control, nothing's working right, you can't lie to yourself anymore, you can't lie to them anymore because they won't believe you. All the con jobs are over with, everything has really gone to pot, and you get really afraid that you really are going to die. Why is it that be you alcoholic or not, the equivalent of three words will come out of your mouth without your even thinking about it? God help me. I've learned a lot from my kids. I got two AA babies, a little boy 7, a little girl 5. A little boy's named Jason. He's beautiful. He's special. Drunks come to my house after the meeting, you know, and we're sitting around talking, and Jason will go straight to the shakiest one in the bunch, crawl up on his lap, hug his neck, and kiss him and say, "Hi, I'm Jason. Who are you?" You've heard of armchair philosophers? Well, Jason was a potty chair philosopher. And when he sat on his potty chair, he wanted somebody to sit there and talk to him and listen to him. And sometimes I got the job. And one night I got the job, and I'm sitting there with him, and out of nowhere, listen to the children. Out of nowhere, he looks up at me and he says, "Dad, Jesus turns the power on." Those are his words. Shook me. I said, "Son, how do you know that? Did your mother tell you?" "No, sir." "Did you learn it in Sunday school?" "No, sir." "Well, how do you know it, son?" And his answer was, "Dad, it's simple. I just know. That's why." The reaction, the call for help, the openness and the willingness of heart come from our lips because they are automatic, folks. When there ain't nowhere else to go, we just know. That's why. And we call down the power. And it comes in like air into a vacuum. Anytime. If we want it, and if we believe it's coming. I'm a free man today. You know that? This book talks about freedom. Says if you want to get sober, here's a how and why of it, Tom. First of all, you quit playing God. Hereafter in this game of life, he's going to be the director. He's the principal, we're the agents, he's the father, we're the children. Most good ideas are simple, it says. And this concept, father-child, was the keystone of the arch through which we passed to what? Freedom. I don't have to control you today, and I'm not afraid of your controlling me today. I don't wake up in the morning planning your life, and I no longer wake up in the morning planning my life. I have no control, and I don't want it. God has it. Chris Christopherson wrote a song once about freedom. The first line was, freedom's just another word for nothing left to lose. When you give it to God, as we say in AA, let go and let God. You're free. That's how simple it is. I was sober about a year. I was sitting up at a retreat at home up at Blue Ridge in the mountains, a beautiful place. I'm a Baptist. I always hated those Baptist songs. Some of them I really hated, you know, because I couldn't be a good Baptist, I guess. I'm sitting back at the back of this retreat, and this gal from New York's up front making one of the most beautiful talks you ever heard. I wasn't hearing a word she said. You know what I was doing? Sitting there singing, Love Lifted Me. Went down to the state convention a few months later, was sitting back on the back row again. The same lady, by the way, was making the talk. She had this effect on me, I guess. And I had to hold on to my chair. You know what I wanted to do? Stand up in that chair and just yell, thank God, I'm free. I'm free. And I am. O.J. sitting beside me on the couch one night, turns around to the dead. Why don't I be the father and you be the son? I said, how are we going to work that, boy? He said, it's simple. I'll grow up and be the father. You grow down and be the son. Folks, look at the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. What does it say? It says you're God's kid, Tom, and he loves you. Don't try to take his place. Be his son. Growing down to be a son. I like little things now. I roll around in the grass with my kids in the backyard. That's a hell of a thing for an intellectual to do. I don't care. Me and Jay's rolling around the backyard there one day, and I got tired, and I stopped, and I picked up a stick and stuck it in the ground. I'm laying in the grass, you know. I took a leaf and put up on it. He rolls smaller circles. He's still going. I put another leaf on it, and he's rolling in smaller circles coming toward me. I put another leaf on it. He rolls in and stops. He says, Dad, let's make a tree. And we made a tree, folks. And I cried, and I got chill bumps. And I went in the house, and I must have been walking clear off the floor. And my wife said, Tom, what's the matter with you? You look different. What happened? I said, Jason, I just made a tree. She said, Joyce Kilmer said, only God can make a tree. I said, he'll have to rewrite the poem. We just built one. Not big, small. I've always said, you know, that I wish I were like my kids. When I say to my kids, hey, I really love you. And you know how kids respond? Yeah, I know it. I can say to Jace, hey, you're a good-looking kid. He say, yeah. Acceptance. I like me. You know that? And it took a long time to get there. An awful long time. Gert Bahana has referred to us as self-flagellating perfectionist. She hit the nail on the head for me. Coming to Akron has been one of the greatest experiences in my life, and it's the greatest honor I've ever had in my life, and I'm serious, to be invited here to talk. I've been all over this country. Never have I felt the way I feel here. I don't want to get religious on you, but I'm going to anyway. A long time ago, a carpenter said, "Come unto me, all you that labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest." And the simplicity of this program is just this. We come. That's all. And he gives us rest. Go home and read the 116th Psalm. I'm getting very close to the point in my life. I feel good. I'm getting chill bumps. You know that? Well, I can say with David, and by the way, David was kind of up and down dude. You know that? One day I was, "Oh my God, you done left me again." The next day I love the Lord, you know? Just like Tom, a yo-yo, and I can identify with him. And I was reading some of his stuff this morning. And there's one that we recite all the time. And it's a beautiful thing. And I feel it now, so I'm going to say it to you, okay? The Lord is my shepherd. I shall not want. He maketh me to lie down in green pastures. He leadeth me beside still waters. He restoreth my soul. Right on. He sure did. He leadeth me in the paths of righteousness for his name's sake. Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for thou art with me. Thy rod and thy staff, they comfort me. Thou preparest a table before me in the presence, right in the presence of mine enemy. Thou anointest my head with oil. My cup runneth over. And then he says, surely, surely goodness and mercy shall follow me all the days of my life. And I shall dwell in the house of the Lord forever. And as a Baptist to his recovery, may I say, amen, and I love you.
Ugly baby and beat the hell with a bubbly stick, but you're a beautiful person today. We are so grateful to you for coming down and leading our meeting this morning, and certainly we are all so much richer for your having been here. We have enjoyed it so much, and as a little token of our appreciation, we would love to present you with old plaque, which says quite simply, in grateful appreciation to Thomas Brady, Jr. for his memorable contribution to the Founders Day breakfast, June 22nd, 1975. Thank you very much.